Hello. In episode 29, series 3 of Airs for Architecture, Neil Kanth-Chaya, architect and scholar, and until 2013, Dean of the Faculty of Architecture at SEPT in Ahmedabad, India, discusses notions of modernism, postmodernism, appropriation and hybridity in postcolonial Indian architecture.
Airs for Architecture, a podcast about architecture, buildings, urban culture and space.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Airs for Architecture. I'm talking today to Professor Neil Kanth-Chaya. Professor, would you introduce yourself? I don't think I can do you justice.
Oh, well, I'm sure you could. But, well, I am an architect. I've been in Ahmedabad for over 35 years. I've been teaching also at the SEPT University for 26 years. And I was born in Kenya and brought up there. And I came to India to do my architecture studies at SEPT, in fact.
Was there a lot of people in the Indian diaspora in Africa that went back to study in India?
Yes. You see, in Kenya, there was only one university at that time. And by the time I finished schooling, it was quite difficult to get into the university. Also, you had to be a Kenyan citizen, which I wasn't. Mm-hmm. And so there were two choices. I could go to the UK for my studies or I could come to India. Mm-hmm. And my father was on his pension, so it was impossible for us to afford the fees in UK. And therefore, India was the obvious choice. And of that, the Ahmedabad school at that time was about 7 years old, and it was one of the leading schools in the country at that time. Mm. And the founders included Balkrishna Doshi and Bernard Cohn, who now lives in France. They were wonderful teachers, institution builders. And so the school was a fantastic place to be in. And I joined there in 1969 and stayed in Ahmedabad for, I studied for, it was a 6-year program at that time. And then after I finished, I worked with Anant Raje, who was one of the very fine architects in Ahmedabad, before I went back to Kenya and worked in Kenya for about 8 years, of which 2 years was in private practice with an architect's office. And then later I was teaching at the University of Nairobi. And so I had this double career, the teacher and practitioner career, right from the beginning.
Oh, that's beautiful. When I did my doctoral studies in Gujarat, I met you in Ahmedabad, I guess in 2007, 2008, over dinner, yes. If I remember rightly.
Yes.
And my friend Prash had introduced us, and I was associated with Hunashala and Vivek Rawal as well, people in center which is based in
Ahmedabad.
And obviously spoken highly of you, and you had this enormous reputation amongst that community of practitioners in Western India, in Gujarat and further afield. Even when I mention I have a PhD student from Delhi at the moment, she's very aware of you as well. So you have this kind of star power, which is quite an interesting. It's quite interesting. Where do you think it's
a great pity, really, because I hate the idea of stardom.
But where do you think this star power? What do you think is behind this? I mean, other than your great charm, incredible good looks, and immense intelligence, where do you think this comes from?
Well, I suppose I'm very friendly to students, and I am able to be part of their thinking process, which is something which a lot of students hang around even now, even though I'm not teaching regularly in the architecture school, still I am continuously in contact with students who want to discuss their project or who want to discuss this or that or the other, looking at their career and so on. So this is something which I think it comes from having grown up in a family where everybody used to take care of each other, and our house was always full of outsiders.
Mm. This is your house in Africa, in Zim?
Yes, Yes, that's right.
Kenya, sorry.
Yes, yes. Yeah. You know, in India, we have a saying which is Atithi Devo Bhava. That means the unexpected guest is your God.
The unexpected guest is your card.
Is your God, God.
Is your God. Oh, isn't that beautiful?
Yes. So the idea of hospitality as the basis of your being is really something that is, to me, very, very wonderful thing. And I would like to follow that as much as possible.
I think you've done that. So I've had you in my mind, and I think I've even cited you in my thesis, funnily enough. But I came across there was a memorial seminar workshop online to Balkrishna Doshi at which you spoke.
Yes.
What was your association with Doshi over the course of your career? I mean, obviously his work, and I don't wonder, you can't draw a line around someone like Doshi's work very easily, but there is this kind of strong emphasis on indigenous identity and the vernacular. Is that right? Mm. Is that fair? Is that where your association?
Well, I came across Doshi's work from the very first day when I joined the School of Architecture. The building is designed by him. Mm. And in fact, I knew nothing about the school, but when I saw the building, I was sure that I wanted to study there. And it was that open, generous a building, not trying to do any show off. It was like being at home. And I think the quality of Doshi's work in many of his works is the sense that there is a sort of openness. There is a kind of continuity. There is an inclusivity. There's something where everything, including his modernist heritage, I mean, having worked with Le Corbusier and having known Khan and worked on his behalf in Ahmedabad, though she had both these, on one side was the very down-to-earth, earthy kind of sense for materials, sense for details, which gave his work a kind of warmth and a kind of significant effect on you when you entered it. And so in a way, yes, it can be said that his work is much influenced by the folk and the indigenous traditions of India. However, he was constantly in touch with all the developments that were happening all around the world. So he was friends with people like Aldo Van Eyck or George Candilis or anybody you can name, Tange, they all were friends with Doshi. And so he was part of that international group of people who were trying to say, okay, modernism did something with technology, but how are we going to deal with the idea that people inhabit buildings? Mm. And if people inhabit buildings, the sense of production of the building is on one side, which is our task, but on the other side is how do we make places which people find easy to accommodate for different kinds of purposes? And there the indigenous comes in. Because if you walk on an Indian street, and I'm sure, Ambrose, you have had that experience, that you're constantly adjusting to so many things that are happening all the time. And in any space, in any building in India, though it might be marked for some particular use, we often change the use as and when the occasion requires it. Mm. And therefore, that quality that, well, space is something to be used. Architecture is something that supports the life of communities, and that it is a kind of something like our clothes, where we wear loose clothes so that we can move around easily. We never wear shoes. I mean, we didn't used to. Mm-hmm. And if you walk without shoes, and you walk with slippers or any other kind of footwear, then your walk changes. And in the same way, architecture also has that quality of, maleability. a kind of ability to take many things. So Doshi's architecture is characterized by that.
Yeah, for sure. It is, and you've raised a number of things that I think are really, really important. I mean, I don't just want to talk about Doshi. I want to talk about your thinking too, but I would love to sort of, and when I emailed you and I made some of these suggestions around topics that I was particularly interested in, particularly the idea of an Indian modernity. But you came back to me with all of these questions around the idea of post-colonialism, post-modernity. So what you've said about Doshi seems to me you're setting him as a counterpoint in a way, or perhaps an evolutionary development of the Corbusian ideas, and perhaps even the Louis Kahn ideas of a kind of India, what modernity is for India, which I find really fascinating. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about this idea and this post-colonial moment in which India has been finding its own identity once again, once it has been left alone, kind of thing.
Yes. So you, if you look at modernity as it occurred in India, many parts of Africa, even some parts of other parts of Asia, we have a double allegiance in a way. Because we were trying to build in a way in which we were saying, this is ours. We wanted a sort of continuity with the ways of life and the ways of building that we had in our own geographies. Of course, our climate was very different, but also our ways of living, of using the daytime, of using nighttime, of being what you do in the early morning or what you do in the evening, all of those had distinct patterns which we wanted to integrate. Mm-hmm. On the other side, we were looking at what the European architects had done, and we found that there was a potentiality there of making an architecture which was not only an architecture which belonged to the rich or to the powerful, but which could have a usefulness for all kinds of people. For example, in the area of housing, but in many, many ways, modernism, one of the aspects of modernism which appealed to us greatly was that it talked about ordinary people, not just about the elite. Mm-hmm. At least in its early stages. If you look at the constructivists, if you look at Bauhaus in its earlier days, if you look at Corbusier's work, many of them were thinking about how do you provide for so many people. And so our modernism, our learnings from modernism were connected to that strain of modernism. But there is another strain of modernism which was to us somewhat insulting. In the sense that one of the things in the European, or at least 19th and early 20th century accounts of history in Europe, they talked about the arrow of time as being a line, and there was progress. So you moved from one state to another, to another, to another, to another, and there were then primitive peoples, or there were less evolved societies, and there were more evolved societies, which we found to be somewhat not very happy, a kind of a box into which to fit. And though we love our primitivism, and we do enjoy the sense that we can not be efficient. We do enjoy that sense. So the idea of progress and the linear arrow of time went completely against the grain, because if you look at our ways of writing history, those ways look at the kind of simultaneity of events, and that there are hundreds of ways in which people respond, and all of those are trying to be relevant to particular contexts, but that does not mean that one is more evolved than the other. And so in that sense, the whole tradition of history was jarring to us. And so we didn't want to be modernists in the sense that we want to be at the top of the progress line. Though there is a part of Indian modern architecture, which also, as a matter of national pride, wants to show we are as good as anybody else. But that is the lesser phenomenon. And I think if you look at the colonial experience, we were told all over the world, the colonized were told, you have much to learn. You have not organized your societies properly, your economy, your ways of doing things. You don't have technology. And therefore, you have to accept that there is a better way, and we are bringing that better way. And the whole of Gandhi's struggle, for example, is about saying, wait, I want to be friends with you. I like you as people, but I don't accept the fact that you tell me I'm not capable. And I have my own ways, which are different from yours, but both may show some ways which might be useful. So there is a different notion towards modernity in India. I think also in some parts of Africa, because I worked in Kenya also, I know that we had the same questions. What is a Kenyan architecture? Or what is an African architecture? And there were so many aspects which I could compare in parallel. Mm-hmm. And I see that people in Japan were doing that before us. People in South America were trying to do that. Though in South America, the European notions were well entrenched. But still, there was a notion that there must be some other ways of working. Mm-hmm. And I think this is something which Indian modernism picked up.
It's really fascinating. I think for a lot of younger architecture learners, modernism is tied almost solely to a series of technological and aesthetic moves. And I think that's a problem of how it's taught. And in a way, it's a way of whitewashing its history. But I'm really interested in this idea of Times Arrow. And I've been trying to get my head around it recently, thinking about, well, trying to see things from a non-Ambrose Gillick perspective, you know, with my thousands of years of kind of, well, actually 500 years of kind of progress-orientated national history. And it's very difficult. It's a very difficult game to do. But I think there's a great deal of value in it, not least because the modern project, modernism as a project, particularly in architecture, wasn't universally valuable in even the colonizer. I think that that's like to divorce ourselves or emancipate ourselves from this very singular idea of what it is to be modern is a very important thing.
Yes.
And I was wondering how does the Indian architect, how did you go about this project in your own self? Obviously the influence of Doshi and that. What did you feel as someone raised in Kenya, that there was knowledge gained there, and then how did you build towards this kind of emancipation?
So I think the first most important thing is that there is no one answer which is the best answer.
Okay.
Modernism and the idea of progress depends upon a notion that one has found the best way, and then we will maybe get more knowledge and we'll find an even better way and then an even better way. But there is always at a given point in time, the best way. Now, if we, on the other hand, think that there might be hundreds of ways, maybe thousands, and learning Swahili was as important as learning Gujarati and learning Hindi and learning French and English and so on, it made no sense to say English is a better language than Gujarati. or it made no sense to say that Sanskrit is the best language. And so it became evident, even from childhood, growing up in a multiracial community, that the kind of notions of separating out the knowledges and privileging some knowledges over others, the most recent of it being the most privileged, was something which was actually working into a kind of mindset which is close to, shall we say, fascism.
Yeah.
Yes. That it says, this is the way. I know it, and you better accept it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I know it. And fundamentally, if you think about it, you will know it too.
Yes, that's right. That's mm-hmm. right. But you, I know that you can't think as well as I do. That's the other thing that I have to tell. And so it on the other hand, now, if you look at the crises of ecology, that sense no longer holds, that we know and we know the best way.
Mm.
We have come to the conclusion that we are floundering around, or we are sort of hedging many bets in the whole idea of trying to say, how are we going to save this planet? And then you look at nature and you see that things have different kinds of time spans. Rocks last for millions of years, and flowers, you know, come into life and then drop the next day. And all these kinds of time are useful times, depending on to what process they are participating in. And therefore, that something which is more recent, is more evolved, is not something which we find in nature. We find that nature is constantly using and reusing things which it had evolved maybe thousands of years ago. And this is something which I think human societies, modernism cut at the root of that. They said, find the one good way and throw away everything that went before. And that violent notion of the idea as something that rules in a singular way is something which is the worst part the last 200 years thinking. And I think that maybe there are many other kinds of ways of looking at knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And we now discover that some of the knowledges which so-called primitive people have are superbly attuned to their environment, to mm-hmm. their conditions, and they are able to tell us things about animals, about fish, about plants, which we didn't know about. Mm-hmm. And I think this is something which now we should become more absorbing of all kinds of possible knowledges, and not say that there is only one and tested way.
The idea that you started with, and you mentioned all the languages, that I'm terrified to think that you can speak all of those languages, but I bet you can. I bet you can. I really find that a very interesting idea, that it's the imposition of a singular sort of language in modernist architecture as a language that has a certain grammatical, syntactical, and lexical form that's acceptable, that then gets applied everywhere. And what you seem to be suggesting is that we need to kind of step away from the language of modernism, which is very singular and doesn't evolve. It's a very strange one, isn't it? I read something recently where someone was talking about, I can't remember which architect it was, but they were talking about their architecture as being extremely similar to modernism that was produced 100 years ago. Actually, if you actually step back from it, aesthetically, formally, spatially, very little evolution has occurred in this one area.
Yeah.
That, funnily enough, we think of as the most progressive form of architecture. And
yes.
then you've got all of this kind of indigenous modernity, which is taking on things in most subtle ways, taking that language of modernism, inflecting it with its own accents, its own patois, its own kind of new words.
Yes. So that's why the architecture of Finland really fascinates us. Because that was one culture from the 1930s. Aalto was trying to make buildings in his own way and still competing with all the modernists. So if you look at the Paimio Sanatorium, you've got a almost a Bauhaus project. But if you look at the plan and how it adjusts itself to the land and to the light and to the landscape and views and so on, he's already doing something quite different. And that you find much more happening in Piatila's work. And Rema Piatila did some of the most, shall we say, impolite works of architecture, because the patois that he was evolving came from the forest in a way. And I think this you can see all over the world, people are trying to break out of the singularity of language, not in the sense of the postmodernist way, which said, oh yes, let's pick up things from history, or let's cut buildings and fix them in different ways. Not that. It's a genuine thing which says, wait, I don't have the tools to make an industrial product. I don't have those materials. I don't want to use those materials because my other materials are so good. Let me try and work with that. And already, even if my plan forms begin with a modernist geometry, already it starts changing. And I think the rhythm of the languages, rather than the vocabulary, it's the rhythm of those languages which becomes truly an indigenous modernity. And that I think you can see in all kinds of works all over the world, where you see, okay, this I'm sure this is not in Europe, and yet it's modern.
And it doesn't involve sort of simply sticking on bits that make it look.
No. That's the worst bit.
It really is. It really is. You sent me this beautiful essay. I don't know if you've published it yet, titled Things That Affect the Works of Architecture, When?
Yes.
And it's a lovely piece of writing.
Thank you.
Start with a Rilke poem, which is one I didn't know. Why Rilke? Like, where does Rilke come into your thinking?
Well, Rilke has an ability to say something without completely fixing it, jamming it into one ideology. That's one. Also, his feel for nature is so fragile and yet so strong. And in that sense, Rilke has been a very huge inspiration for many of us who speak Gujarati. In the Gujarati language too, Rilke's poems are thought of as very great poems. So it's very interesting. Rilke has had a huge impact on literature in India.
Isn't that interesting? And in translation?
Sometimes in translation. Of course, in translation into English is available to all Indians, or most Indians who read, also read English. So But into the local languages as well. I know that in Gujarati there are some translations, and I know that perhaps in Bengali there must be. So that because his feeling tone is very similar to Indian poetry. Yes.
I when I read his work, I'm struck by it. It's obviously modern poetry, but it's not modern in that sense of a lot of other work being written at the same time, which finds itself lost within concepts and language. And
yeah.
I mean, great poets like T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound and people like that, whose work you can, it's so complicated.
Yes.
And that's nice, you know, that has its place. But Rilke, I always find it's got that clarity about it, which is very similar. I mean, if we were to compare it to a form of architecture, I think you're right. I think it's like Alvar Aalto or Asplund or Balkrishna Doshi. It's got that purity of, that it synthesizes complex ideas into something that's very refined and also very approachable, which is this idea. So this is a very heavy kind of levering in of an idea, but there is that kind of a sense of sensibility in this architectural work that you're talking about. Go back to what you said earlier. There's a desire to make an architecture for the ordinary person, the everyday experience of the ordinary person.
Yes, yes. And so, you know,
go on.
Just like Rilke's writing, the Japanese haiku is also something which just hints at an idea and lets you suddenly realize it. And some of Rilke's shorter poems are like that. And I think this is something which you find in architecture. You will find that there will be in India, in the tradition, there will be sort of moments in which suddenly light or shadow works in a certain way. Or the view that you get from somewhere as you turn a corner suddenly opens up into something. This becomes a kind of a aha moment. And this, we try to ingrain it into all our works because we do feel that it's not the total structure, but it is the savoring of moment after moment after moment, which is really the appreciate or the, it's the aesthetic experience is not just the totality, which sometimes comes towards the end. There are, for example, theater traditions in India where the theater performance goes on for 27 days, every night for 27 nights. And it's so slow. And yet, in every night's performance, there are three or four moments which are like, wow. Same thing happens in music. When we listen to Indian music, you have to listen for hours. And at times, it sounds so repetitive. You are almost in a kind of, what do you call it? A daze. Yes, a trance. But then suddenly something happens and say, and you alert, awake again. And I think this kind of quality is in Rilke.
I think this thing about the ecological crisis as a crisis of unknowing is, I think, a fantastic thing. But I wanted to come back to a word that I had put to you, a word I encountered when I was in India, that someone, I think it was Vivek Rawal who actually first told me about it, was this idea of parampara. And I have a lovely book, an Indian book, on parampara. And it was this idea. So I was looking at indigenous architecture, vernacular architecture, and the way that it was being modeled, modified by contemporary technology to make it more robust in the face of ecological and environmental disaster. And this word, and from our perspective, vernacular architecture is something that was done and we now kind of pickle and we leave on a shelf and we look at and we say, isn't it beautiful? But we don't do that anymore. We do modern things. And you know, and if anybody has the temerity to approach vernacular architecture, we call it pastiche or kitsch or something that's bad.
Yes.
And this word parampara, as I understood it, was this idea of tradition as an evolving present.
Yes.
And I put this to you, and you said, well, it's a bit more complicated than that. And I was wondering whether you could...
Yes. So in the best sense, parampara it's a word which in its very sound, twice par parampara. So it is saying again and again. But in its best sense, it talks about the fact that nothing happens in a vacuum. And there is no first instance. There is always a deep history to anything that we do. Today we are talking in the English language, and both of us are following a parampara, and therefore we can understand each other, and we can hook our thoughts to ideas which have occurred before and straight away understand what one is trying to say, through because the English language has many hundreds of years of parampara. And so in the best sense, parampara is that. But there is also a sense in which the parampara can be a kind of cage. If you hold on to it too clumsily, then it can become a something that prevents you from actually seeing the moment as it occurs. And I think if you look at Zen, for example, or if you look at Buddhist thought, or you look at much of the art aesthetics of India, we have a word called chamatkar. And chamatkar means a miracle. If that's a very bad translation, but it means an instant in which suddenly something happened, which was not expected. And if you're too deeply entrenched in parampara, then you're too anxious and you can't see that new thing which is being born. And so there is a double learning in the Indian tradition. One is know everything that happened before as far as possible, but learn to divest yourself of it the moment you are in the real. The real is something which cannot be held in any framework. Now, with that, then the parampara word becomes very, very complex. But it's a very fine, it's a word which, of course, can be misused in order to force people to behave in certain ways or to follow certain customs, traditions. For example, I can say, caste is a part of my parampara. And then that looks at a tradition which ought to have died out. As I understand that human beings or all kinds of life have equal right to be dignified, I must put away that idea of caste the moment I realize that. So in that sense, this has been something which has been misused also at times. But it must always be balanced by the openness to sudden realization.
So has that idea of the potential tyranny of parampara, has it always been, have people always been conscious of that possibility? I mean, obviously you can't speak for all time, but
no.
Has it been something that's been within that literature, that kind of...
Yes. There is, if I might put it that way, there is a kind of Protestant literature in India. Mm-hmm. You see, there is, on one side, there were the texts written in Sanskrit, which were written in the form of dialogues very often, and which were open to different kinds of interpretation. So the standard method was, there would be a text, then there would be a commentary on a text, then there would be a counter commentary, then there would be again another text, and so on. So it was always left open, and this is one of the traditions of the Sanskritic mode. But during Buddha's time, for example, Buddha and Mahavir found that the hold of those who knew those languages and who were the Brahmins had become too ossifying for society. And they rejected, and they said no. And the tradition of saying no belongs to the other languages. So if you look at the last 1,000 years of Indian history, then a whole lot of vernacular languages came up. And in each of them, there were poems and tracts written which denied the parampara, and which said, for example, if you take a poet like Kabir, he is a poet who says, just because you have shaved your head and painted something on your forehead doesn't make you a good person. So he's saying, forget about all of this. Look at what you are. Now, if you look at, if you put it in architecture, the Brahminical parampara is in temple building and in the geometries of certain kinds of buildings of power. But there are hundreds and perhaps thousands of ways of building which say, okay, we understand, you got a lot of money, you got a lot of power, you can do that, but I am doing this. And that's how the Indian city, you will see that parts of the city, suddenly you will find this temple which is so carefully constructed, or a palace. But the rest of the city is all the time shifting and making the best of whatever locational qualities it has, using a tradition, an artisanal language of building, which is quite different from the sort of official language. And I think this is how, for at least, if you go up back to Buddha, it's 2,000 years, there has been this contestation between the tradition as stated. Fortunately, we do not have one sacred text. So it's written in the Bible, so therefore, no, it doesn't work that way. And therefore, we have had lots of voices. And this somehow is also a way of keeping alive the discussion, that you never come to a conclusion.
It's a very interesting idea. I mean, I've been listening to you talking about this idea. How on earth do you teach this kind of architecture? Because obviously what we do here is we give them a brief, and we give our students a brief, and we say, you will design a building and the building will be complete. And you talk about this in your essay, When, as well. Like, what on earth does this mean? After I read your thing, I asked my students, like, what, you know, where does architecture happen? This is a very simple question. Where does architecture happen? Does it happen when you conceive it? Is it your conceptual sketch? Is it when you finished your drawings? Is it when the ribbon is cut by the mayor and the building is open? But and then this contests the idea of who the architect is. Is the architect the person that, architects don't build buildings. They draw pictures of buildings.
Yes.
And they manage contracts around buildings. You know, it's, so it becomes very, very complicated. So we draw this red line around it. We say this is architecture. But in this idea of a kind of a hybrid, and this is Arjun Appadurai talks about this hybridity, and Homi Bhabha talks about it as well and contests it. Because Bhabha's interesting, I think, because he contests it around the idea that there is anything to hybridize in the first place.
Yes, yes.
Because it implies... hybridity implies some sort of purity on the other side, and that's problematic, or it's actually absurd. So how do you go about educating in a way that enhances this architecture? I mean, just in terms of your own practice in Ahmedabad, I mean, how have you engaged this form of thinking?
Well, the first thing is that the question of authorship has to be given up.
Okay. That's a lot to ask.
Yes. But it happens in practice really all the time. And then you either feel very sad that they didn't accept my ideas, or then you say, oh, these people, they have no understanding, but they're paying for it, so I have to do it. Yeah. You know, there can be a negative way of looking at it. I, on the other hand, always enjoyed the fact that the guy on the other side who is going to pay me my fees is actually a thinking person. I once had a client who said, I don't know anything about this. Please make whatever you think is good. And I gave up that job immediately because it is in the continuous. So when does architecture come into being? Well, not in the first idea, not in the middle period, not in the development of the design. It actually is continuously transforming itself. And several years into a building's life, you go back and you see that they have started using it in a way in which you could never have thought of. And this is very amazing. At times you feel very bad about it, but at times you are really fascinated that, wow, this is something which I didn't think about, but they've found a way. So I think that the question that there is a single mind which makes architecture is one of the hurdles. And in studio, what I've started doing is that I don't tell the students that that's going to happen, but we play a kind of game of, what do you call it? Anyway, it's a game in which your design suddenly, without notice, goes to the next student. And a few days later, goes to one more student. And finally, it comes back to you after having passed through five hands. And you say, oh, hell, what have they done to this? And then you again start working and you start realizing that you are. And the students who are less egoistic find this very enjoyable. And the students who have a sense that, oh, I know, and I want to be the designer, they find it extremely anxiety creating. but some ways have to be found where we give up this kind of a desperate hold on ideas. Mm-hmm. And for that, there are so many techniques. For example, one of the techniques that I use in my own practice, but also in the school, in the studio, is make Xeroxes of plans at a particular scale, hundreds of them. Then sort of throw them around and cut parts of them and start building up a plan out of that. By which what you do is that you find things by accident. And at least the scales are taken care of.
Yes.
That you are quite sure that the small space and the middle-sized space and the big space are all there in the right proportions because you've taken good works of architecture. And I take them from all over the world, not just from India. And it's an extremely enjoyable way of feeling less anxious about my responsibility as well. But of course, then it goes through an evolution where I take my responsibility again more seriously. My responsibility as a craftsman who has to make sure that things hold together. And through that process, I think, and this is how it used to work. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at the entire artisanal tradition, how were the Gothic cathedrals built? They were built by people who had some notion of how that plan is going to be, but it went on for centuries, and generation after generation of builders added to it. And that was still a great work of architecture.
Yeah, for sure. India has been subject to lots of people coming in and telling it how to live its life, which, I mean, it's kind of weird. To put it mildly, how does, but the Indian diaspora is enormous, and Indians bring their knowledge and their ways of being. And as you said, you know, these traditions of home and home life and family form and all of these things. How do we create an Indian architecture abroad? What can Indian ways of thinking, can I suppose, Indian ways of thinking about space and architecture be applied in other contexts?
That's very interesting. You know, my brother lives in in Wooster Park in London. And he has bought a house which is like a series, you know, a standard townhouse, which you find in the suburbs of London. And then his daughter was to get married. And they had to have the singing ceremony and the food ceremony and all those ceremonies. So where does that occur? And how does that occur? And the best thing was to go into the garden and make a tent under which all these things could happen. So I realized, and then my mother, who was by then 84 years old, went to live there, and she had to find her ways of using the house, because it was a very English house with very clear ideas of privacy and so on. So she found a seat in the living room from where we could, she could see the staircase. She could hear what was happening in the kitchen, and she could see the children come in when they came. And so to her, that was her world. So I think any architecture, first of all, it doesn't have to change its total fabric. It has to take into account different ways of using it. And it's very interesting how so many different kinds of people. I went to, in London, there is this area, Elephant and Castle, where there are all these Ghanaian shops of hairdressers with pictures of women having these hair like that. Fantastic area. And it's, they have appropriated that, or rather they have simply started living there without worrying too much about what kind of building they were in. So in one sense, there is, to architecture, the possibility of it receding into the background. And the foregrounded works are all that we see in the magazines or in the, and but it's the background which is equally important. And I think this is something which was talked about in the 60s. Sarinan wrote about it, but it's not really developed, that the background works, and which have to be loose enough, have to be capacious enough to accommodate all kinds of things. And so I often think that the markets in London, if you go to Brick Lane, or if you go to, I went to South Indian shops in, I've forgotten, Islington it was. These are various parts of London which have all these things. And they've become completely, they're still English people. I once went into a shop which was selling Indian sweets. And, you know, we buy sweets by the kilo. But here's this young English person who comes in and says, I want one peda. And this fellow just takes out one, puts it on a plate and gives it to him. And that's 50 pence or something, whatever it was. And it was fascinating to see this shopkeeper adjusting to that other way of thinking. So this is something which goes on between cultures. And I think this is something which is happening all over the world now. And we are all beginning to appreciate. So we have, you know, in Ahmedabad, we have kinds of pizzas which you can never have thought about. An Italian would just tear his hair out, perhaps. There is a bhaji pav pizza. Bhaji pav is an Indian savory, and it's slapped onto the pizza, and we buy it, we eat it. Same thing happens with spaces, with architectural spaces. Yeah. In one moment, we will be in this glass fronted room looking at a garden. But soon we'll open it up and we'll be coming in and out, and the children will be running through. Mm-hmm. And all that is part of that kind of gradual softening up of the boundaries, which I think is one of the good things in recent times. But of course, the reaction to it of going back to fixed identities, which is also happening all over the world, is somehow terrible. And so architecture has to be at that middle point where it says, hey, I don't know who's going to use this. Maybe today I'm designing it for you, but tomorrow it might be someone else. And it has to have a value which is not fixed to distinct cultural identities.
Fabulous. Thank you very much, Chai. That was absolutely amazing.
Thank you. Thank you, Ambrose. I really enjoyed talking to you. And I hope that we will be able to meet again. Yeah. And maybe I can feed you some of those pizzas.
Well, you can, just feed me Gujarati sweets. I'll be happy with that.
Okay, great. Wonderful.
Well, thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
In the drowsy dark caves of the mind, dreams build their nest with fragments dropped from day's caravan. Never a truer word said. Thank you to Chaya for taking the time to speak with me. It was a joy and an honour. Please see the podcast description for links to Chaya, including a wonderful video discussion and memorial to the works of Balkrishna Doshi, and including former podcast guest Yohani Palasma. And thanks for listening.